Do you relate to any of your villains?
Yeah, because that's the whole idea is that if you can relate to them, it makes their evil that much more shocking. Because I have a tendency to relate to all of my characters in some way, shape, or form, because it allows me to give them some kind of humanness to their character. But I'm sorry, my dog is drinking.
Oh, I could tell.
Yeah. Are you thirsty? Are you good? Lay down. Villains have to have purpose. And if you can make them relatable, then that purpose becomes so much easier to lay out. Because if you have somebody who's just a cardboard cutout spouting off evil, like he's some kind of dark wizard in Tales from Verania, that, you know, that falls flat and it doesn't make sense. And it gets boring. I get bored with stuff like that. So if there's a villain in a book, I want to make sure that he's completely relatable and that you could see where he's coming from, even though you definitely won't agree with where they're coming from.
Welcome to the Clunatics Podcast. I'm Kurt Graves. This week, we're doing something new. We gathered a group of Clunatics to have a roundtable discussion of T.J. Klune's antagonists. Are they evil? Misunderstood? Are villains just the hero of their own story? Like most of the topics we discuss here on the Clunatics Podcast, the answers we come up with may surprise you. A couple of warnings. There are some gentle spoilers for T.J. Klune's books, so proceed with caution. And this conversation also contains a political joke, which we've left in despite the Clunatic rule banning political talk, precisely because it is, in fact, a joke. Here's Chelsea, Melissa, Angelica, Tanya, Danae, Susanna, and a special guest, breaking down what makes a villain.
Hi, I'm Chelsea. I'm from Seattle, Washington. And as I was thinking about it, my favorite villain, I think, is Owen from Extraordinaires. He, without spoiling too much for in case people haven't read it, I think he's very misunderstood and he's got a lot of stuff working against him. And I feel that he's going to come around. At least that's what I'm hoping for. I hope he gets a good ending, but I guess we'll have to wait a few years to find that out.
TJ likes to do that to us. Melissa, who is your favorite villain, and introduce yourself, please.
So this is Melissa Logan. I live in Newton, New Jersey. I'm a Leo. And so I'm going to say my favorite antagonist is Santiago, because I think he antagonizes so well. But if we're actually going into villain category, that's really complicated for me, because there are people that I would consider villains that are not necessarily traditional villains. So if I were to say, for me, my favorite villain would be Thomas, and that is probably controversial, because he's somebody that I love to hate, but I do think makes a better antagonist than hero. And I know that really depends on perspective in the book. So for me, it's complicated.
Fair enough. We will talk more about Thomas later. Tanya.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tanya from St. Paul, Minnesota. And I'm good. It changes from book to book on who I think is my favorite villain. Right now, I think it's Mirren, because he's somebody that he had love, he had a family, he had so much, and he deliberately threw it away because he chose to go with his destiny as he saw it, and deliberately made the choice to, he sees love as a weakness, and it was something that was holding him back. And I just think that's very sad. And he's a very complicated character, and that is what intrigues me.
Awesome. Angie, what about you?
Okay, hi. I'm Angelica. I'm from Canada, Edmonton, Alberta. And my favorite villain would probably be Robert Livingstone, just because of his motive. He has such a very, complicated motive. Like, we don't know exactly the whole story behind why he even became a villain, Like, we have bits and parts of it, but not the whole truth. So that's really intriguing me right now to figure out, like, once we get the last book, what exactly happened in his, I guess, in his point of view, what made him turn into what he became into. Especially now that, you know, just like the whole thing of him turning into, like, quote unquote, like this beast werewolf, like that's really intriguing for me. So I can't wait to figure out what's going to happen now with that.
Yeah, it comes up in the last book.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, someone's read it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, someone has read it.
I know things. Danae.
Hi, I'm Danae Young, and I am from Colorado. And I have a really hard time. Sorry, hold on a second. Go back to your room. Go play. Sorry. My husband had a meeting at the last minute. Right? I have a hard time picking an exact favorite villain because they're all really good. But the villain I hate the most would have to be Julie McKenna from Bear, Otter, and the Kid because personal reasons. She's just like... It's so easy to have a friend or somebody you know that has that mom that just sucks. And she just sucks the life out of you and just messes up her kids. And seeing that as a mom and seeing that happen to other people and then living through it yourself, it's just that woman is like the one. I just hate her. Can't stand her. But I agree with Melissa on Thomas Bennett is also another one of my top bad guys.
Susanna, is Julie McKenna, is that the one that Mio really wanted us to talk about?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, she got
it. I mean, yes. Yes, good. She does.
Susanna.
Hi, I'm Susanna, and I'm bringing some continental flair to this panel because I'm from Australia. So my favorite villain is always the self. So like Gus's need to be normal. He feels like his self gets in the way of a good thing. Like Bear is a classic example of his own brain himself getting in the way of happiness. And so I think that's my favorite because it's so relatable to me. Like everybody is their own villain, really. When you stop yourself from doing something or you think you're not good enough, you're the villain in your story. So.
Wait, if we're going abstract, I have a totally different.
You had your turn. Sorry.
You know, well, maybe this will give you a chance to talk about what you just mentioned, Melissa, but something that Susanna just brought up is the idea of like a villain you might actually relate to, somebody you might see yourself in. Is there anybody else who feels like there's a villain who may not be their favorite, but they maybe see themselves in that person a little bit?
I feel like Owen from The Extraordinaries. The whole, like, especially his relationship with his father was very, like, it's very common in teenagers to have that kind of relationship with their fathers at that age and to have that affect him so much for his dad to, like, take advantage of him, basically, when he's at his lowest. That was really, like, that really hit home for me. So I felt like, dang, like, that was pretty close. I felt that was pretty intense. To see that, especially when at the end we find out that he's going to therapy and all that, but he still has like a lot to, I guess, redeem himself. But who knows? Book two, we'll find out, I guess.
Don't we love trilogies? Aren't they?
Love it.
Anybody else relate to a villain?
I was going to say like what Susanna and Melissa were saying was the self-villain, right? Like Sam of Wilds, he's great and he's magnificent. He can do all these wonderful things, but he's always down on himself because he's the poor kid from, right, the bad side of the tracks, the bad side of town. And so I think in myself, I'm always questioning, am I good enough to take that next step, to do that next thing? And I think that's what makes the self-villain or the internal villain, your own worst enemy is what makes it very relatable. Every character can be relatable in TJ's books to people because I think everybody does that to themselves on some level. Some of us harsher than others.
Yeah, Melissa?
So it's interesting because I don't see the self necessarily as the villain. So while I would relate to that, there's another piece of that I don't relate to. That's bigger for me. So I think the bigger thing is the lack of choice or the lack of agency that
that to me is a bigger villain in across the books. There's a theme of destiny or a theme of choices being taken away from people. And I relate to the pain of that. I relate to the impotent rage that comes with losing agency. I think that that is something that I relate to, and that the choices that then people are left with, you know, Gordo, I relate to Gordo's anger. I relate to, and to even to a certain extent, Robert Livingstone's desire to burn the whole world down. I get that. I don't ever see myself drawing my children into that. Like, I can't relate to him on that level, but I relate to that desire to burn the world because of something that's happened that felt out of my own control, you know? So I think that's a bigger thing for me.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up Robert Livingstone and the lengths he ends up going to, because his villainhood is sort of born in trauma. Like, you meant like something terrible happened, and then who knows what his nature is or what he would have been willing to do. But certainly I think there's a traumatic event that then spurs him to go and do some really, truly horrible things, to be more ruthless, I guess, is what I'm saying. And as somebody who hasn't read all of TJ's books, is that maybe a theme that we see in some of his villains as well, that there's a traumatic event?
I feel like there is a theme, but that's not always like a traumatic event. It's always kind of like depending on, I guess, the main character. Like with Gus, like that's the villain is himself. And then I think with like the Cerulean Sea, the whole, what were they called again? Forgot their name. Oh, higher up, the higher up place or people. I felt like they weren't really like a villain. It was just more like Linus fighting the system in that case, rather than them fighting an evil person or an evil individual whose motive is to hurt the main character. So I think there's like some theme, but then he does have different villains that aren't really like bad guys per se. I think it's more just like, like an obstacle, I guess you could say, that the individual or the main character has to kind of overcome.
Yeah. It's interesting that you bring up House in the Cerulean Sea, because I was going to ask, who is the bad guy in that book? And you're saying extremely upper management. Did anybody have a different take on who the bad guy in Cerulean Sea was?
I saw the bad guy as, how do I want to say this, systematic or systemic perception, right? The thought that because they're different, they're bad or evil or not wanted. And that's just perception passed down from, you know, generation to generation through actions and words and policy and whatever. That's not really super tangible, but was obvious. They've segregated these kids. They're, you know, they have whole systems to check them throughout their lives and make sure they're being good citizens when, you know, from being children, they're told that they're wrong. So I saw that as the villain, which again is not a person, but like a concept and easily changed, sort of, right? But still very deep-seated and hard to root out.
Susanna, did you have something to add?
Oh, I was probably going to just go simpler than that and say that fear is the villain in that book. It's just fear of the unknown, fear of something that you don't understand. So, yeah, that's all.
Isn't that, in a way, often born of its own kind of trauma? People fear either what they don't know, or they fear as a result of a triggering event, and then they enact systems that are intended to, you know, prevent these triggering events from happening again, regardless, by generalizing and then oppressing and, you know, systematically marginalizing and oppressing people. So I still think the trauma argument kind of stands here too a little bit, and it makes sense to me.
I would say, like, with TJ, I think in almost every book he has, you have the villain that everybody portrays, but every main character themselves is their own personal villain. Because in almost every single book that he does, each character has some type of self, like, loathing and worth, you know? I mean, Sam of Wilds, you know, never feeling like he's going to be good enough. You know, Gus has his whole, he wants to be normal. You know, it's in every single book, you know, in The Extraordinaries, he wants to be an extraordinary. You know, Ox wants to be a wolf, you know, and he has that from his dad. You're never going to be good enough. Every single main character in every one of TJ's stories, I think, is unique because they are their own villains more than the villains are. Because if you're constantly fighting that battle in your own head, am I good enough? Am I worthy enough? Am I? It's harder to defeat a real villain when you don't feel like you have that worth yourself.
Yeah, Melissa.
There's another theme in there, not necessarily in all of the books, because I don't think that this is a theme in the How to Be books, but secrets, right? Secrets are at the heart of a lot of the trauma, a lot of the self-recrimination, a lot of the self-loathing, a lot of the, you know, the deep questioning that people do, and that lack of agency and the inability to make good choices, is that somebody at some point has deprived people of information that would have changed the entire course of their lives. Thomas does it with everybody. Morgan does it. Randall does it with Sam. Sam does it with, you know, his cohort of friends. It's in actually a lot of the books, and it's at the heart of a lot of the problems that everybody faces. And that lack of transparency, that lack of honesty, is a real villain in a lot of these books too.
You know, as we talk about this, the other thing that comes to mind is a lot of what you guys are talking about, the people keeping the secrets, the people putting the protagonists down. A lot of them are parents or parental figures, which is very interesting, knowing what we know about TJ's life and past. So
if we're going down that road, a lot of the villains in TJ's books have twisted love. Robert Livingstone has twisted his love for his children, and he has twisted, you know, his relationships. Thomas has twisted his relationships. Julie McKenna has twisted her relationships. Throughout all of these books, there is these relationships that should be loving, these relationships that should be nurturing, that should be caring. You know, Mirren and Randall and Morgan and you know, even, you know, between Morgan and Sam, these are relationships where there is some sort of betrayal. There is some sort of key defining moment where everything has gone horribly wrong, and what should be loving and giving has spoiled.
A lot of TJ's villains is that whole trope of the call is coming from within the house. Like, you know who the villain is, or they've got a backstory that is significant to other characters or characters that the main character loves, and so it sort of adds that depth to them as a person, because if they're lovable, then they're not, there's got to be something redeemable about them.
I'm curious if, as readers, you guys find it more interesting to have villains that are sympathetic, or is it, if it's more enjoyable to have just a cut and dry villain that you can defeat and get rid of?
Yeah, I do think that a sympathetic villain is much more interesting to me as a reader, because they have layers, they're complicated. It's very easy to have a one-dimensional villain, and sometimes that's good for a story. But what I enjoy about TJ's books and his writing is that most of his villains are multidimensional. And you're talking about a sympathetic villain in the first book of The Lightning Struck Heart. Justin is a villain, really, to Sam. But yet, as you keep reading through the story, and as it progresses, you start to see a different side of him coming out, and your view of him changes slowly. And then throughout the books, you know, all of a sudden they're best friends by Veva and he's part of the cohort and he's there and now he's getting his own book. So there's a redemption arc to that that can be done well with a sympathetic villain that I can really appreciate.
Okay, so we're going to need to put a massive spoiler warning at the start of this episode for the Extraordinaries, because I just cannot not talk about, like, I know we've people have mentioned him already, but I think part of this book for me was going along this path of thinking, oh, like, I know the bad guy. Like, I know the bad guy, but he's just a teenager. I can see that he's got troubles with his father. He just wants someone to love him. He just wants to be part of a crowd. And then getting to that point, I had this moment of, oh man, no, this is a lot worse than I thought. So for me, the real surprise of that book was realizing that the villain wasn't necessarily as redeemable as I thought, but then I'm also torn because I'm so hopeful that he does get in through the rest of the series, he does get to come back from this and eventually he comes to terms with all these things and learns how to love and be loved and all this sort of stuff. So it's like, I hate him, but I love him because I just want him to have a happy ending. And it's really hard.
You know what? Yeah, that's very similar to how I feel. Yeah, definitely the villains, I feel like they're so much more complex the way TJ writes them. Because a lot of times when you read books, there's a very, like, cutthroat, like, this person's the bad guy, there's no redeeming qualities, we just want to get rid of him. But I kind of like that we have that kind of way of kind of getting to know them by the main characters kind of viewing their actions from a different angle. Sometimes, like, for example, like, Gordle with Thomas, like, we see Thomas as this kind of, like, cool, like, father figure for Ox, but Thomas' actions that he shows to Ox are kind of like not authentic to what he really is. But with Gordo, it's more like he's showing his more vulnerable side, more of his, like, I guess his, in a way, his weakness to the pressure of having to be out, you know, alpha and having to kind of keep up that appearance. But with Gordo, he kind of cut loose and was like, hey, I can't do this on my own. I want you to help me. And it's odd because Gordo has been so traumatized by Thomas, and for him to come back and be like, hey, can you help me? It's interesting because you hate him in Ravensong, but then when you read Wolfsong, you're just like, oh, Thomas is such a great guy. It's like, like you can't hate but love him, but hate him at the same time. So I appreciate that kind of multi-layered character, because otherwise if I had just read Wolfsong, I would have just been like, oh, Thomas is great. But with Ravensong, it changes everything. So I think for me, that's why I love that.
I was going to say, back to your, you know, what makes them, why we like them with their layers is, and kind of what Melissa was saying with agency, is a lot of the big bad people, there was an event or there's a point in their life where they had a choice to make. And, you know, as a person, you would think, what would I do in that situation? And it's not necessarily this giant thing, like I can take over the world like Mirian, right? But even as simple as, you know, Per and the kid's mom and Tyson's mom, Jenna, you know, she had a choice and she chose, and granted, she chose not to ask for help, right? She chose not to do a lot of things. Robert Livingstone, he had bad things happen to him and he's chose to hold on to his anger this entire time. He got his revenge and he's kept it going. And it's those choices that everyone can or can't make, right? Gordo was in the exact same, not the exact same position, but a similar position. Everything was taken from him very quickly. And he could have very easily become a villain. And I think they'd stated somewhere in Ravensong, right? He could have become a villain, but he just chose to be an asshole instead. So he made a choice to not go down that path. And so I think that's what makes it relatable, is like, wow, would I make that same choice or would I make the better choice? I don't know if I'm that, you know, selfless to make the better choice.
Yeah. I would like that on a t-shirt, please, ASAP. I could have been a villain, but I chose to be an asshole instead. Whoever is producing that, I will buy one. And it will be your first.
There is something compelling about a sympathetic villain, but I think actually what I find in TJ's books particularly that I find more compelling is who is the traitor and who is the betrayed? Who is at any given time the bad guy? And from different perspectives, like Sam of Wilds is the hero until he's not, you know, until he does something really shitty and then he's not. Every single person has that moment, like what Chelsea was talking about. They have that moment of choice as to how is this gonna go? And sometimes they choose in a way that makes them the villain to somebody else, the oppressor or the traitor or, you know, whatever makes them the bad guy in a particular instance or in a particular relationship or at that particular time. And it's interesting to me how that theme plays out in so many of the books and how the tables can turn. And somebody who has been very sympathetic or has been heroic is suddenly maybe not so heroic, but we're still pulled along with them, and how easy it is to kind of yourself be the bad guy by following along with somebody and making excuses and you know, playing down the badness of what somebody has done because it's a character that you have found sympathetic. And that's what makes rereads so interesting is that, like, for example, the first time I read through the Green Creek books, you know, I was all on Team Thomas. And then after I read Heart Song, I was like, oh, wait. And I went back and reread them. And I got it to Raven Song and was like, Thomas, you're bad. You guys kind of suck. Like, and you have that moment where you're just like, have I been rooting for the bad guys? Like, oh my gosh, am I a bad guy? And you don't know, am I team bad guy? And then it's pretty easy to be team bad guy in TJ's books. It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
You don't realize you've been dragged along for a while.
Yeah. Susanna, you had something to add.
Oh, I was just going to say that's why I'm so excited for Tales from Verania book 5 is that we're going to see it from Justin's point of view, and we are going to see Sam as sort of the foil. And I think that's going to be so, TJ's going to just do such a good job of that. And I just can't wait because we've seen glimpses of it in the series, but this is just going to be like a whole book. I'm excited. That's all.
Are there any other villains? And I know a lot of narrative arcs have been wrapped up in the last few years with TJ's books, but are there any other villains you're hoping get a redemption story? Nobody jumped in with Robert Livingstone? Hope that guy turns out okay? Nobody?
No, no, I want him to burn.
Fine.
I feel like with Robert Livingstone, it would be nice if we could see him kind of maybe not so much redeem, but maybe realize just how bad his actions have been towards his two sons. Because God, did he fuck them over. Like that is, oh, anyway, that's all I have to say for that.
Yeah, Melissa.
Oh, if we're viewing Thomas from the villain lens, you really hope that he fixes shit by the end of the book. Like, you know, he keeps coming out of the mist and you just like, he didn't fix anything. Abel didn't fix anything before he died. Thomas didn't fix anything before he died, which is another theme of sort of passing on the sins of the father throughout these choices, right? So the choices that compound with each generation, the choices that compound with more decisions being made, and somebody else being responsible for fixing those problems. I would like just once for somebody else, for somebody who made the problem to fix the problem. So if Thomas could do that before he disappears back into the mist, that'd be awesome.
I completely agree. Oh my God.
Just not saying anything for now.
He's in a teasing teaser who teases.
Yeah, you're the villain of this panel, Kurt.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Why, thank you. As an actor,
I have to say, your mustache.
Playing the villain is way more fun. That's okay. I would be super happy if there was suddenly a book 5 in the Green Creek series and it was from the perspective of the bad guy, because I think that would be delicious. Oh,
so you're saying
no,
because like I think Robert is the one villain that I just don't understand. Like, I don't understand his not, I can understand that need for power or wanting to be the one, but I don't understand his motivations as well, possibly, as the other villains. Like, I feel like the other ones have this sort of twisted version of doing something good, maybe, but he's just fucked up and I don't like him.
Danae, what did you have to say?
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say Robert's just fucked up. She took the words out of my mouth. I think it'd be cool if maybe TJ reflected back on like Thomas a little bit, you know, like if there was a book five and it was kind of like before Ox and Joe and the kids, and kind of like give Thomas that redeeming feature, because I mean, a lot of the books have the parents suck, and I get that because parents suck, but it'd be really cool if he could just kind of like, you know, go back and give you that redeeming, you know, this is why Thomas did what he did. You know, this is his whole reasoning behind it. Might not make sense, but it might make you have like a little bit more empathy for Thomas, because like Melissa said, I was totally Team Thomas from the beginning. I'm like, man, this is a book where they've got good parents. Things are going really well. And then you hit book three and you're like, never mind. Thanks, DJ. That was totally messed up. None of your characters have nice parents, you know, besides Sam. So I think it'd be kind of cool if they did something like that.
Well, I was going to say, you know, we were just talking about Thomas and, you know, we loved him and then we hated him. Well, not hate him, but, you know, more from protagonist to antagonist or however you want to say it. And I'm sure somebody on this panel knows already, but it's going to be interesting to see Thomas through Carter's eyes. Carter is the first child, right? He's going to have hero worship for his father, at least, you know, at least in his younger years. And as he's growing up and with Kelly and Joe coming and being that big brother and getting that wisdom from his dad. And then, you know, what he pieces together from after his grandfather from Abel dies, to the choices that Thomas makes to take them to East and then to come back, and then him suddenly dying again. I'm hoping that Thomas isn't necessarily redeemed, but that we get a better understanding of the choices he made. I feel that Thomas, the reason he loves humans so much is because he wolves are the same. I think he thinks the wolves are the same. They're just people. Because he wasn't ready to take over, right? It was a bad thing happened, and suddenly he's, you know, alpha and, you know, king of the wolves, basically. And so then he suddenly has all this pressure put down on him instantly to make the right decision, to make the right decision. And hindsight, not the right decision, but he keeps trying to do better. And he finds himself lacking, I think, at the end, too. So that's what I'm hoping for. Brother Song helps out Kirk. Little hint teaser is that we see the other things.
Let the record show I had a complete poker face and I let nothing show as she was talking.
So this is going to be the sorry, not sorry podcast, right? That's what I'm hearing.
Oh my God. I was just thinking about, like, with Thomas, like you said, he's forced to make like all these decisions all at once, sort of like with Joe when Thomas died. That kind of made me think about like Abel, like how much pressure he was under with Abel was around. Because I think a lot of people forget that Abel, what he did to Gordo, that was messed up. I mean, like, what kind of person does it take to have a young child get tattooed by his father and for him to just be like, oh yeah, this is fine, this is good, this is where it's good. Like no, that's really messed up. So for Abel to be like the leader of, you know, of all the wolves, it kind of makes me question whether or not he had good intentions for everyone involved. Like, if he was having quote-unquote good intentions for Gordo, for him to be the witch when he was so young and he was not prepared at all for that responsibility.
Yeah. Danae and then Melissa.
So since we're talking about parents, Julie McKenna, I'm crossing that line right now because you're talking about all the parents. That dirty B word, let me tell you what. It's like out of all the villains in TJ's book, and I know Mia feels me on this one because she's awful. Like, I'm a parent, and don't get me wrong, I fuck up my kids all the time. Accidentally, of course. But you don't realize when you're doing it. And then later you go, I shouldn't have acted like that. I shouldn't have said those words. Take a step back. Okay, guys, let's talk about what just happened. You know, like, let's go and approach how we got in trouble. What did we do? We treat our kids like they're adults, and a lot of people don't agree with that because, you know, they're children. But you can't treat them like babies forever. They're never going to learn. They're never going to grow. But what Julie did to Bear is just, like, I get so mad because it's like she never let him be a kid. He never had that opportunity to just be a kid. It was like from a young age, the world was thrust upon his shoulders. He had all these responsibilities, and she constantly just took a crap on him, you know, between her drug addictions and everything else going on in her life. And yeah, you can kind of sympathize with it, but I'm one of those people that if you have shit going on, then take care of your shit before you put it on your kids. Drop them off somewhere. Get them someplace safe and then take care of you. It's not fair to put that all on them. They are children. They need to learn. They need to grow. They're what's going to lead the nation or, you know, the world eventually. And when you just take a dump on them, what are you doing for them? So I'm done. That's my parent rant. Julie McKenna sucks.
Nice. I know we have some other things to get to. Before we jump into that, I did just want to say that I thought there might be a perspective that was missing. So I did invite somebody else who's pretty familiar with some of TJ's villains to come and chat with us as well. So I'm just going to bring him into the chat now.
Hi. Hello. Hello. Is this the Clonetics meeting?
Hi, Tex.
Hi, how's it going? So glad to be here. Very big fan of TJ Clown. Glad to finally join the group. Been a big fan for quite a while.
Yeah, we were just discussing his villains. Yeah.
Well, he doesn't have any villains. No, TJ Clown only writes the kindest, gentlest creatures of this earth. There's no villains.
Fuck. He can't even...
I'm sorry, I was just rattled by all these friendly doves. They tickled my ears. They seem to gather around me whenever I speak because I'm a peaceful being, much like all of the characters of TJ Clown.
So you don't think any of his characters have any flaws or might be
flaws? No. All slices of perfection. Different rinds, bits of the same orange. Perfectly rounded individuals, all comprised of a utopian identity.
Well, but even there are parts of an orange you don't want to eat.
Not me. I just bite on in like it's candy. Nature's candy, that's what they call it. Accented only by its bitter edges.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. I mean,
I don't want to interfere too much. Just fly on the wall, you know, listen to y'all ponder the intricacies of questionable villainry characters of TJ Clown.
Okay. Thanks for that perspective.
Oh, no, I have not offered up much of one.
Well, we agree on that.
Let's continue on, though, as it is the right thing to do. Being polite, I've never done anything that could be considered villainous.
No.
So I don't even know how we could ponder such a thing.
Well, now that we have a new perspective, maybe you guys have some questions for Tex?
Absolutely, because I'm a bit astounded. I'm a bit offended at the idea that you might assert that there are any wrongdoings, wrong features of any of the characters of TJ Clown. I'm a bit offended.
Yeah, go ahead, Danae. Danae has a question for you.
Absolutely.
So, Myron, what's your feelings on Myron's character? There's no evil in there at all?
No. He's a gentle soul. A bit confused, maybe, but always intentional with the right convictions, if not a bit misguided by being caught in the whirl of his own whimsy.
Yeah, Angelica. Just fire him off at this point. Tex, I think, can handle it.
All right, well, what's your thoughts on Santiago?
Oh, it's kind of young man. Very calm and sweet, sentient, biped. I believe all of his thoughts are maybe a confused poetry, but poetry nonetheless. He was quite a sensational human being, if not fed by his eccentric lasciviousness.
What about Vince and Darren's dad? We like him now?
Maybe he's righteous by different means than the right means that exist in the real world.
Oh my god.
Nonetheless, I can't be conceived of as anything but an angel.
Oh, okay. You really cleared that up for me. Thank you. Yep.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Can I go back to Susanna's point earlier about Robert Livingstone, and we were talking about his motivations. What are his motivations?
Are you asking me or Tex?
Tex.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry.
The insight.
Who is the character?
Robert Livingstone.
Oh, no.
What are his motivations?
That's an interesting question. I think that when we dream, sometimes we ponder the unfounded realms of life that seem to haunt our well-beings. And in that, there's maybe a scope of, well, in the unknown, in the void, which we all have to face constantly, everlastingly, there are contradictions with convictions that everyone is swayed to by their peaceable means. Period.
It's clear as mud now. Thank you.
Perfect. Now, I'm really curious, Tex. One book we haven't talked about at all is Murmuration. I'm just wondering who you
Great think, book, great book.
Who you think is the bad guy in that book? Like, who's the villain?
The birds. They are.
Oh my god.
That's a theme too, right? Evil birds.
I was going to bring up Johnny Depp, but
seagulls. Oh yeah, seagulls. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Seagulls. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, that is an angel come fallen from heaven. Johnny Depp. One that enunciates just the psalms, if you will, of a lost generation. The quibbles of porridge from the sky. Okay. All right.
Sounds like you prepared a lot for this text.
Yeah. I don't know.
I am really impressed with how long you kept that up.
I'm happy to. We can just edit this part out, and I can just keep going with it.
No. It's really nice to have you with us.
Okay, yeah, I just got a little Michael? Tired.
Okay. I can imagine why.
Can we talk about Murmuration, or has everybody read Murmuration?
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. So you cannot talk about the villain in Murmuration without spoiling it. Like, I don't think there's any way that I could even hedge around it, because it's sort of like you learn to love the villain before you realize who the villain is.
With Murmuration, god, I love that book. I can like re-listen to it 1,000 times because it's just so freaking awesome. It comes back to that whole the self-loathing, the self-mutilation of TJ's main characters, you know, and you don't realize it's the self in it. A lot of people, like, I gave it to a couple of friends because I've converted some people, and they all swore it was the guy who made the machines. No, he's the villain because he forced these people into this world. But no, it's not. It is the main character. He is his own villain. And it's the battle that he goes through, because it's almost like multiple personality disorder. You know, how you remember one world and now you're in a different world and you're trying to figure out what world is real, but then you know yourself because you know, I've got anger issues. I've got these problems and I had them in both worlds. So it's just that whole, he has those characters and they're so relatable because everybody has something that they hate about themselves. I mean, you can't say you're perfect. I'm sorry, but nobody is. But I love how TJ just takes those parts and just splays them open for the world. Listen, this is my problem. And then throughout the whole story, they like have to overcome it. And Murmuration is just like, he has to overcome his issues in order to, you know, be who he needs to be in the end. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, Susanna.
But it's also like, how much of that book I feel like really examines how much of being a villain is just the series, is the series of events that you live through. Like, are you a villain just because of the series of unfortunate events that's happened to you that has led to this point? If everything had gone differently, maybe you would have been the hero. But, you know, you fell on bad luck with your job, or you married the wrong person, or this happened, and it just sort of started snowballing into you being, I don't know, Donald Trump. I mean, that's a big snowball. That's like a really steep hill, and the snowball's like not even a snowball anymore.
It's a yellow snowball, Susanna.
Yeah,
it's
a yellow snowball. Sewage plant, it's just like gone, but...
I myself was very surprised when he made an appearance in Murmuration.
Yeah.
Right, the third act reveal.
Yeah.
You know, that conversation makes me think about too. It's like so much is about the context, sort of as you were saying, Susanna, like it's the series of events. Like in the context of that book, of what we get to see from, you know, if it's a movie from the first frame to the last frame, yes, you could say that the main character is the villain. You could say everybody in the town is the villain. You could also say that none of them are the villain. None of them really do villainous things in the context of the story that's told. We only find out about things they did elsewhere. And again, we don't have the full context for that, even as much as TJ fills in the blanks for the main character. And so, you know, it makes me think of the fact that like, every one of us is probably the villain in somebody else's story. Like we are the bad guy. Even you, Susanna.
Am I the bad guy in your story, Kurt?
So it depends on the day.
Oh God.
But you know what I mean? Like we at some point, probably without even realizing it, have wronged somebody in some way, and we are the villain in their story. They do not like us. Maybe we'll never even know.
I've seen it.
Not me. I am a benevolent oil baron, and the lands that I bestow power upon, they all love me. I'm no one's villain.
Lady Tina, I was just thinking about that. How she technically is not a villain per se, but to Sam, what did he call her? Like evil incarnate. So it's interesting to see how she went from being like his sort of, I guess, rival per se.
And nemesis.
Nemesis. There you go. Nemesis. And it's interesting because you see how she acted like, you know, a typical teenager, just fangirling over Ryan and everything. But then when she realized just how wrong she was about Mira and how that affected everything, how she tried to redeem herself. Like, I thought that was really interesting to see, because if that had not happened, we would have just kept seeing her as, you know, Sam's nemesis. And really, I think that's really interesting to see that in a book.
Yeah.
Normally that doesn't happen.
Was she evil or single-minded?
Mm-hmm.
Because she really just had the one thing in her sight, and then she didn't see everything else around it until, like, she couldn't avoid it anymore. And then she changed, which I think is probably true of a lot of us. But the conversation about, like, we're all somebody's villain also makes me think about the fact that, like, so, Michael, you and I have to bring some of these villains to life. We have to imbue them with characteristics that sometimes have to trick the listeners into thinking that they're not the villain for a little while, or sometimes we have to be outright villainous in a way. Like, when you approach a villain character, especially in TJ's writing, what's going through your mind?
Well, Michael, what do you have to... All right, Tex, sit down for a minute, and let me answer this question. Sorry, he's a big personality. It takes up a lot of space. And it's a bit that's very successful. So I'm glad that I brought him along.
I'm so happy you two found each other and are quarantining together.
Yeah, in a very tight space. You know? I think that TJ's villains are, I don't know, in all the series that we've done, it's not surprising when a villain rears themselves. It's like they wear themselves on their sleeve. And so coming across them, it's like you have to question, like, what's the motivation? What drove this person here? Because as Tex astutely pointed out, like, everyone is coming from their positive motivations. You know, if it's revenge, then it's like vigilante justice. If it's like, there's some kind of rectification. It's in the eyes of the hero, the protagonist, it is villainry.
but in the eyes of the villain, it's self-righteous. So, I don't know, just acknowledging that they are human and they have logic and they have their own motivations, it's usually pretty compelling. And then, I don't know, yeah, it's just, once you add the humanity into it, then it becomes a fuller character. And some of the volumes of like what makes them a villain too, it gets filled out more by, you know, if someone makes the choice to turn evil, that's a big choice. And that means that they have their own big personality, you know, that they, like Tex, he says he's not a villain, but we all know.
It stands to reason that if each of us is the villain in somebody's story, that the villain is also the hero of their own story.
Well, and think about it, how much evil gets done in the name of what's best for you? I know what's best for you. So extremely upper management. Even somebody like Robert Livingstone holding down his son and hurting him is doing it for his own good. And there's a lot that can be excused in somebody's mind when they're convinced that they're doing it for the greater good or for someone's particular own good, or in a self-serving way, for my own good, right? The world is best served by power being in their specific hands. There's a lot that comes out of what is good and what is good to me, and our own perceptions about what we're reading is informed by what I think is good or what the reader thinks is good as they're reading. And then that perception shifts when we start to change perspectives, and something, when you read it the first time, you're like, oh yeah, this is the one true way. And then you read it the second time and you get to another book, or you read another book and come back to this one with a different perspective. You're like, shit, I was wrong. And you flip-flop, you know, you now you know more than you did before, and you change your, it colors everything you've read before, whether it's a different series or it's another, the next book in the series.
Well, I mean, that's Julie McKenna, isn't it? She thinks she's doing what's best for Baron Tyson. She thinks if I leave them, that's what's best for them. And so we view her as a villain, but she thinks that she's doing the right thing. Oh God, I hate her so much. This is really hard to do, but I promised that I would come on here and speak kindly of fucking Julie McKenna.
I was just thinking about perspectives too, and the Extraordinaries, and how your perception and Nick's perception of who the villain in the story is changes as you learn more and go through, and Pyrostorm's the villain, the story, and then the narrative shifts and secrets are revealed and you realize how much perceptions can be wrong about who the true villains are. I thought that was interesting.
That just reminded me of like Robbie, of the whole thing that happened in Heart Song, how his perspective of, you know, of the pack, like Michelle Huge is the, she's the alpha of all. Like that really does kind of do a number on Robbie, and it kind of is interesting to see that, because later on, of course, as you read the book, you realize just how messed up what Robbie got, to the point where he's just like, who's right, who's wrong in that situation, until finally when the secret's revealed and he figures out, you know, this is my family. So I have to be, I guess you could say, I have to be like the ones to protect them rather than fight them. Does that make sense?
That's such a good book. Oh, totally tore my heart out, but it was such a good book.
I know. We're forgetting a big villain, Michael Bay. How can we not talk about Michael Bay?
Or TJ himself. How have we done this entire conversation and not talk about that edging bastard? Who constantly teases us.
Did you guys see the Instagram post that he had with the notebook? Western 1880. Yeah, who knows what that could possibly be.
You know, my question is, are there any actual psychopaths in any of TJ's books? Because like everybody just said, you think of all the different villains, Robert Livingstone, you guys have your theories, like, you know, you can empathize with him. He's a dad trying to do what he thinks is right for his son. Is there a single psychopath in any one of TJ's books who's just someone who is messed up and causing chaos? I can't think of any of them.
I think Robert Livingstone actually falls into that category, because even before he had his triggering event, there is nothing normal about holding down your child or treating his children the way that he treated them. That is explained, that you can explain away in any way, shape, or form. And then after his triggering event, he's clearly had a break with reality, and it's all gone pear-shaped. But yeah, I would say he's the one villain in the villainverse, in the Clooniverse, that I really have no sympathy for. Because even Juliet McKenna, right, who is kind of shit, could have been worse, right? She left her youngest child with Bear, who could do it, right? He did do it, and we saw that he was able to do it. It was really shitty what she did, but she could have pimped them out. There's a million other parents that we've seen where that could have gone horribly worse. And it was selfish, and it was, but like somebody else pointed out, we don't know her backstory. There are other things that could have gone on that would have made her a more sympathetic character if we had more of her backstory, right? But, you know, I'd say Robert Livingstone is that one person where there's nothing that you can tell me that's going to make any of what he did normal. So like, if I had to pick like my worst villain, if it came down to the bracket, it'd be Mirren and Robert Livingstone head to head. And I think Robert Livingstone would win just because he would let the world burn. I think Mirren has enough of a self interest that there's a limit for him. I don't think there's a limit for Robert Livingstone. I don't.
I was just gonna say, I could argue the point that Rob, back to, and I don't remember who said it, it might have been you, the being the parent and knowing best. And I don't have all this, you know, but there's lines in there where Robert is telling Gordo that don't trust the wolves, right? Don't, you're going to work for them, you're going to help them, but remember, you're better, they're different, you can't always trust them, you can't always do this. So again, not what he did was right, but it was coming from, I'm going to make sure you have the power to stand up to them and do what needs to be done because you can't trust them because of, again, a secret. We don't know. Maybe we never find out. But there's a reason, whether it was his own family that told him that or whatever, something bad is going to happen because it always does. And it happened to me, so I don't want it to happen to you. So I'm going to make sure you're as powerful as possible, as early as possible. Again, not the right thing to do. Right? Choices, secrets, parents know best. Goes back to that, I think.
Yeah, because another thing he's done too is also messing with his wife's memories. That's really messed up. That was even before the whole thing with him losing his tether and everything. No, he was clearly like manipulating her memories so for his own convenience, because he didn't want to deal with her overreactions, as he said, to the wolf business. And he just clearly just wanted his way with her. And with Gordo having been so young, he didn't see what was going on behind closed doors. And then afterwards, when all these things happened, then you see this other side of him trying to be like this, I guess, trying to be this father figure towards Robbie and trying to be like, oh, I gave you a home, I gave you a place, and this is how you treat me. Like, he definitely has some major issues there. And now I'm scared for like, for another son, I don't want to see his name, another son who's also going to have to deal with him and how he's going to like, I don't know how he's going to come out from that. Like, is he going to be scarred as badly as Gordo was because of his father? I don't know.
I think this is a great question for us to end on. And I don't even need us to answer it, because I think it'll make a great conversation question within the Facebook group and online. So for all of our listeners, make sure that you let us know who you think the biggest villain in the Clooniverse is. I just wanted to say thank you to all of you guys for taking the time to have this conversation. Michael, thank you for taking the time to join us. And Tex, thanks.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. It's the least I can do. I have tons of time on my hands after making billions upon billions of dollars in the Texas reserves.
oil reserves, that is. Black gold, Texas tea, I like to call it.
We really appreciate your time and perspective as well. So with that, I will say good night or good afternoon, depending on where you are. Enjoy the rest of your nights, those of you who have more to do. And just remember that every terrible thing that's ever happened to a character that you love was done to them by T.J. Klune.
The Klunatics podcast is produced by Susanna Frigo, Louis Garcia, Angela Nolmoan, Sita Rajasingham, Mia Skabaris, John Steiger, and me. This episode was written by Sita Rajasingham. Special thanks to our season sponsor, Tex Tycoon. JK, it's still Chelsea Vrizweibelt. Make sure you're following the Klunatics podcast on social media, join our Facebook group, and find us on Instagram and Twitter using @KlunaticsPod. All episodes are now available on YouTube as well. If you want to support the podcast with a financial contribution, hit the donate button at klunaticspodcast.com. Your generous donations allowed us to make a $500 donation to the Trevor Project. Donations collected after July 1st, 2020 will be banked for a potential season 2, and please include the name of a charity you think needs our support when you donate. We love the Trevor Project, but we like to spread the love. Additional information about the podcast, including episode transcripts and the Klune speak, Don't Be a Dictionary, is available at klunaticspodcast.com. You can find out more about me and my work at kirtreads.com. That's kirtreads.com. All music and sound effects heard in this episode are licensed by Storyblocks Audio.
But you know what? If I'm occupying that much space in their head and they think I'm a villain, then hell yeah, I'll be that villain.